You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Darrell Conner.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, if you admire what someone's doing, why not tell them? We talk about how to give genuine compliments, and this is harder for some of us than others, how to receive them.
First, it's time for our weekly review of state news. Ashwaubenon-based retailer Shopko is taking steps that could signal bankruptcy is in its future. Wisconsin continues to feel the effects of the ongoing government shutdown. And following a request from Senator Tammy Baldwin, the Air Force will investigate claims of sexual misconduct within the Wisconsin National Guard.
Robert Mentzer is a statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin. He's based in Wausau. Rob, welcome back. We thought we had Robert Mentzer. Hold on just a moment. Rob, can you hear me?
I can. Aha. Can you hear me?
We can now. I think that was on our end. Rob, let's start with the news that Shopko apparently is planning to file for bankruptcy protection from creditors. That doesn't necessarily mean the business is closing, but there have been announcements of store closings in Wisconsin and elsewhere. What does all this mean for Shopko?
Right. So Shopko, which is a Wisconsin company, they're based in Ashwaubenon, the Green Bay area, and they've been under pressure as a lot of, you know, retail chains, as a department store, have been. And for at least a month, it's been quite apparent that that they're making cuts and changes. They sold off much of their pharmacy business to Kroger stores. And what, you know, this week, on Monday, my colleague Jeff Bollier at the Green Bay Press Gazette got the scoop from a court hearing that the company is expected to file for bankruptcy protection next week.
And this is something a lot of jobs are at stake here in Wisconsin. They're based in Wisconsin, and they've had a lot of stores in the state.
Right. I mean, it's a big company there. So it has 5,000 employees in Wisconsin, which includes the store employees as well as the people at the corporate headquarters. But there are 360 stores in 24 states. So, yeah, I mean, it's a significant chain.
So we'll be watching for the details, I guess, next week is the expected filing. What are we going to find out then?
Right. So what happened? This was the court hearing that we reported on this week was what was at issue was that there's a pharmaceutical supplier that makes the claim that it is owed $67 million by Shopko, and so it was in the course of that hearing that this information was revealed about the upcoming bankruptcy hearing. So, you know, bankruptcy, as you mentioned in the intro, is a process. It is a legal process. It can take a while. So if the company enters into bankruptcy, it'll be about, you know, negotiating on with debts and making determinations about whether Shopko can make changes or cuts and still move forward as a company or not. You know, we've seen in other businesses that are in the sort of the same line of business, Sears, JCPenney, Yonkers, all have either severely contracted or closed in recent years, and Shopko is facing the same pressures there. Especially, it was noted by one of the analysts that Jeff talked to was they're especially susceptible to the growth of these dollar stores and retails, kind of like these discount places. Has taken a significant amount of market share away from Shopko. So it's a company in trouble.
We'll watch for more news on that next week. Also this week, Rob, Democratic Senator Tammy Baldwin sent the Air Force a letter asking for an investigation into alleged sexual harassment in National Guard units here in Wisconsin. What do we know about this?
Right. So, I mean, this stems from... So this was a scoop of the Associated Press this week, and it stems from a whistleblower in the Madison-based Wisconsin Air National Guard. And there are claims here from between 2002 and 2016, and specifically involving sexual assaults or instances of sexual harassment. Sort of the allegation is that there's a culture of sexual harassment and that, you know, within this unit, people are inclined to look the other way, I guess, if it involves people who are in positions of power there. So this person, Jay Ellis, who's a master sergeant in the unit, had sent a letter, a detailed letter, to Senator Tammy Baldwin. And this week, Baldwin's response, her letter, calling these allegations serious and requesting an investigation, became public for the first time.
And do we know if this investigation is going to go forward?
Looks like it. I mean, you never know, right? It's so there will be a response to this. The Air Force and the National Guard has already indicated that they will look into these issues. And it's hard to judge from this distance, right? The AP did not name those involved, but indicated that apparently there is some documentation, like contemporaneous notes that were taken or that sort of thing, but there don't appear to have been formal complaints, so it may be challenging to investigate. There will be a response. It's like hard to know what it will lead to. You know what I mean?
Talking to Rob Mentzer from USA Today Network Wisconsin, looking at some top stories around Wisconsin. Rob, I want to take a quick survey of how the federal government shutdown is affecting us here in Wisconsin. In one way is meteorology. There are things we don't know now, in part because of the federal government shutdown.
Yeah, I found this really interesting. But yeah, so a piece of environmental data that is important to meteorologists is water temperature. And normally during the winter, they use data that's taken, measured by the Coast Guard. And it tells you, how much moisture is going to be in the air, and that means how much snow could fall. And during the shutdown, they can't do it. And so, right, so it's literally the case that our weather forecasts are worse or less reliable now as a result.
And then beer. Craft brewers, including the Milwaukee Brewing Company, have some issues with the government shutdown, limiting their ability to develop new lines of beer if they're planning to sell them outside of Wisconsin. What's happening?
Right. This is one that folks may have heard of. But, yeah, there's a federal alcohol agency that is in charge of approving these licenses for breweries and approving labels for beers. If you're going to sell them across state lines, that's why it becomes a federal matter. And that function is shut down. And, right, so there are specific cases in Wisconsin. The Milwaukee-based Lakefront Brewery is waiting on approvals for a new beer that they want to roll out and can't. And in the Wausau area, in Mosinee, there's this new brewery, Mosinee Brewing Company, that is open but cannot yet sell its own beers. It can only sell, other brews because its license is on hold and they can't, get a hold of anyone and figure out what – they can't move it along because the function is closed down.
And also, Rob, this isn't happening yet, but if it goes on much longer, this shutdown, food assistance programs in the state might start to, their funding might start to fall off.
Yeah, I think everyone is sort of looking at it's sort of a graduating process of how serious things could get if the shutdown does continue, right? People are worried about food stamp losses, and one program, the WIC program, Women, Infants, Children, it exists to provide nutritious food for poor women and families. They're in the point where they're getting worried. They're not affected yet, but within weeks, not months, those benefits could end up being cut.
Ending on a lighter note, Rob, winter sports season is here. Not a lot of snow to be found in some parts of the state, but people may have a chance to do some speed dating, right? This is a thing. You meet lots of different people for a few minutes, but this is speed dating on a ski lift.
Yeah, I like this. This is a fun story out of Milwaukee that we could use a fun story. This particular event happens at Wilmot Mountain near Kenosha. And, so you ride a ski lift. They said it's open to people from ages 21 to 70, but they group it by age groups. And, you ride the ski lift up with a single, and you see if it's somebody that you like and if you want to, ski down the hill with this person.
Now, I'm married, Rob. I'm not dating. If I were doing this, though, I would hold off until I found somebody who had some, medical training, a nurse, a doctor, a paramedic or something. who could help me when I injure myself on the way down the hill. How about you?
Yeah, I was thinking, like, I've never heard of this, anything like this at Granite Peak and Wausau, but then I realized I wouldn't have heard about it because I am married and I do not ski, so it really would not enter my radar, probably.
We'll leave it there. Rob, have a great weekend.
Thank you.
That's Rob Metzer, statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, with us for a look at some of the top news stories from around the state.
Do you want to make the world a little bit better or brighter? What if doing that was actually easy? When's the last time you complimented someone else, whether it be a stranger or a coworker? Our guest says giving compliments can help spread some goodwill and comes with a few bonuses, like maybe some free stuff even.
On Facebook, we ask you if you remember a time someone gave you a compliment. One listener remembered a time as a very little kid, maybe 4 years old, when she had a new dress and new shoes, and her older brother and her first best friend told her she looked pretty. She says to give compliments. She says we should give compliments with honest words. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Tell us about a time you've been complimented. How did it make you feel? And do you try to make sure and compliment others? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
Nate Cornell is an associate professor of cognitive psychology at Williams College. He wrote the post, Compliments, How to Get Happy and Make a Better World, for his Psychology Today blog. Nate, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Nate, what got you thinking about compliments when you wrote the blog post?
Well, actually, it was a essay that was written by a student of mine who's a senior at Williams. Her name's Grace Mabee, and she wrote an essay, actually, partly because of something that I had said to her, and then I read it, and basically her point in her essay was, people could give more compliments and they're missing opportunities. And when I read that, I started thinking about it and realizing how true that was. So I started, kind of as a New Year's thing, trying to give more compliments myself.
And then we ended up
writing this essay sort of together.
Nice. Why should we give compliments?
Well, I mean, compliments can be really, really powerful sometimes. Like the quote you just read from the person who remembered a childhood memory. I have the same thing. Like, I remember when I was like 5, my mom told me that I was good at cutting with scissors. And I was like, wow, that's awesome. You know, like, I remember that now, and I'm sure my mom forgot about it like 5 seconds later. But I remember it because it was powerful, you know?
Yeah.
And it's like, it's emotional and it feels good, but also sometimes a compliment can actually, it can change someone's life. I mean, you know, I'm a professor. I talk to students, and sometimes if there's something really special about someone and I tell them, they might not know. You know, they might not know that, for example, they're a really good listener, or that they're different than other students and that they have this ability. And that can change a life. I mean, really.
Do you think giving a compliment to a stranger has a different effect than, say, giving a compliment to someone that you know well?
For sure, yeah. Because if you're giving a compliment to someone you know well, there's sort of a level of trust there, and there's a relationship that makes it different. In a way, though, giving a compliment to a stranger is almost, if it's really sincere, which is crucial, a lot of times it means if it comes with no strings attached, and you're just sort of like a random person comes up to you and says, you know, you're awesome. Like, then you just assume, well, maybe every stranger loves me. You know, that can also be really, really amazing, I think.
Nate Cornell is an associate professor of cognitive psychology at Williams College. He wrote the post, Compliments, How to Get Happy and Make a Better World, for his Psychology Today blog. And we're talking about how to give compliments and why we should. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Susan in Burlington. Good afternoon, Susan. Welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for listening to my comment. My comment happened a long time ago. It happened 40 years ago when I was at probably several weeks before my second child was born. And a friend of mine saw me at an event and said, oh, you look so nice. And I didn't feel as if I looked especially nice just a couple weeks before my second child was born. And the best part about this is 40 years later, I don't see this friend very often, but when I do, I smile, and I can't tell you how many times I have told her, thank you for picking me up at a time when I really needed the boost.
Susan, thank you so much for the call. Nate, I think sometimes, as Susan alluded to, when you're feeling your absolute worst and someone comes to you and says how great you look or how nice you look, it's something that you never forget. You always take with you, correct?
Absolutely. You know, I have a similar, not in my personal story, but I had a student who had this terrible phone interview and she was feeling terrible. And I was like, she's an amazing student. I love her. And so I just told her, like, you know what? Whoever interviewed you is probably a jerk and they're probably mean to everybody and you're going to get this position. And like, she said it was the only thing that made her feel better. She ended up getting the position, by the way. But when someone's down, a sincere, a real thing that makes them feel better can be so important, because you feel so alone when you're down, you know, and you feel like everything's wrong. And all of a sudden one thing picks you up and then you realize, no, everything isn't wrong. Things are going to be okay. I mean, the other thing I want to add to that is you don't always know. Like, I have a story for mine. Like, last week I went to the dentist and the dental hygienist, like, did her thing. It wasn't a big deal, but she was great. Like, she was super nice and it was super painless. And so I just told her after, I was like, because I had been inspired by my student to do more compliments, I was like, you know what? Like, that was really great. You're a great dental hygienist, I think. And she said something like, she said, thank you. And she was like, that means so much to me. You just can't even understand. And I was sort of taken aback, because I think that happens a lot. People say, like, that means so much to me. And it's because they don't get compliments for their job, or they don't feel good about themselves. And you don't know that. You can't tell. But if you raise somebody up and they are down, it can mean a lot.
Let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Owen in Wyoega. Owen, good afternoon. Welcome to Central Time.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking the call. And I just wanted to thank Mr. Rob Parrott for what he's doing with Central Time. I listen to Central Time quite often. I'm starting to learn more about your new guest or new co-host, but I don't really know much about him. But I wanted to take the chance to thank Rob, because I believe that Rob is really doing a good job at actually broadcasting the news the way it should be, and he brings the guests back on topic when they lose their ability to stay on topic. He also is really good at listening to callers and then being able to convey their message and try to get through to the guests what the caller is trying to express. So,
thank you so much, Owen, for the call. And Rob Ferret thanks you as well. And, you know, while we're on the subject, I know that, Nate, if we're going to be giving compliments, we should probably work on being able to accept them. And I know that some of us, including myself, have a tendency to minimize the compliment in some way, or give the credit to someone else, or just respond with another compliment. Why do you think we have a tendency to do that?
You know, I don't know. I do the same thing when someone gives me a compliment. I try to, it's almost like it's embarrassing. And so you just want to make it go away, and then you kind of think about it later, right?
Yeah.
I don't know why.
Yeah. Any tips on how to respectfully receive compliments?
Well, I mean, I think the main thing is to let it sink in for a second. And then really the best thing to do is just to say thank you and acknowledge that you feel good. Because when I give somebody a compliment, and then they smile or they feel good, or I can tell that they care, it makes me feel good too, you know? It's almost like like I said before, it's a win-win. But when you receive a compliment, if you want to be nice and pay the person back almost, you just let them know that you appreciate it.
Let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Becky in Monticello. Good afternoon, Becky. Welcome to Central Time. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. You know, I love what you're saying about lifting people up and everything, and I work from home, so I don't see a lot of people every day, so I don't get a lot of compliments. But I have been trying more to pay attention to people as I see them on the street or in a store. And if I notice something about them or about the service they provide, I try to be specific and sincere and pay them that compliment. And it's really fun to see how it affects people. Like you said, you don't know if they're having a bad day, and you point something out and suddenly it lifts them up. So I think this is a really great topic. Thank you.
Thank you for the call, Becky. How do you feel about that, Nate?
Yeah, no, I mean, I agree 100%. And in fact, I think the main thing I learned as I've been reading and thinking about this is that you need to turn up your radar for giving compliments, because there are opportunities that sort of pass you by sometimes. You know, like somebody, like my dental hygienist, she did a great job. So I would have just gotten up and left. But instead I thanked her and I complimented her. That happens a lot. Like, there, you know, you're walking along and somebody's wearing some really cool outfit, and sometimes you can tell, like, they're wearing it because they want a compliment, not because you're like a, because they're demanding it from you, but, you know, like, they look different than everybody else because they have flashing suspenders on, so they clearly think that their flashing suspenders are pretty cool. Compliment them. And I'm just saying, if you have the ability to see that someone would appreciate a compliment from you, look for that. You know, spend a week just trying to see those, because when you start seeing them, it brightens your day too, you know, especially because a lot of times you'll end up having a conversation with the person.
Nate, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate you spending the time.
My pleasure.
Nate Cornell is an associate professor of cognitive psychology at Williams College. He wrote the post, Compliments, How to Get Happy and Make a Better World, for his Psychology Today blog.
As of today, the partial government shutdown is tied for the spot of longest government shutdown in U.S. history. This time, the disagreement is over funding for President Trump's proposed border wall.
But the original record holder was a shutdown in 1995. That was over a balanced budget fight between then-President Bill Clinton and the Speaker of the House, Newt Gingrich.
It lasted 21 days, and unless things come together before tomorrow, the current fight will take over as the longest shutdown of the American government in history.
Our next guest has written about how shutdowns have morphed into the big political fights that we see today, and he's got a couple ideas for how Congress and the President can avoid them.
Roy Myers is a professor of political science and an affiliate professor of public policy at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. Roy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Great to be with you.
We're in the midst of a shutdown now. It seems like we've been here or close to here a lot lately. It wasn't always this way, right?
No, most shutdowns have been relatively short. And in fact, most of them occurred in the 1980s. It wasn't until 1995-96 that shutdowns became as long as they have been recently. In fact, after the 95-96 shutdown, the memory of the disadvantages of that shutdown was so strong that we didn't have another one until 2013, but unfortunately that was a long one as well. And now we're going to break the record tomorrow.
That's a little complicated, but I understand that some procedural changes in the 70s and 80s set us up to where these shutdowns were more of a possibility. What happened?
Yeah, the big change was in 1980. President Carter's attorney general named Benjamin Civiletti issued a ruling that if there was a funding gap, which means that the agency hasn't received its regular appropriation, and therefore it's lacking permission from Congress to spend money, then it has to shut down its non-essential activities. Before that ruling, when there was a funding gap, agencies just tended to spend a little less or a little slower than they otherwise would have. But after Civiletti's ruling, once there was a funding gap, the agencies actually had to shut down. And in the 1980s, during the Reagan administration, there were, in fact, were 8 shutdowns, although they were all short. They lasted at most 3 days long.
What was the reasoning behind that decision to say, okay, no approval from Congress, we're going to shut it down, at least in part?
Well, in part, it's just a plain reading of the Constitution, which says that agencies are not, government agencies are not allowed to spend money unless they receive appropriations from Congress. In addition, there were a series of laws passed in the late 19th century that we commonly call now the Anti-Deficiency Act. So somebody who works for the federal government who has the right to spend money will violate the Anti-Deficiency Act if, in fact, an appropriation hasn't been passed. So in some sense, what Civiletti was doing was protecting federal civil servants from being blamed for spending money when they had no constitutional authority to do so. However, his ruling was so tough that it became obvious that shutting down the government would be really counterproductive, particularly when safety and health was involved. So he modified his ruling in 1981 to allow some exceptions, but still the basic idea was that if Congress and the president couldn't agree on an appropriation for an agency, then those operations had to cease.
Now, on a certain level, this is a balance of federal power issue, right? This is the executive branch spending money, but saying, wait, hold on, if Congress doesn't sign off, they're supposed to have the power of the purse strings. We can't spend that money. So at least philosophically, the way our Constitution is designed, that's not inherently a bad thing, is it?
Right. It's political scientists, we tend to talk about our checks and balances system as one of separated institutions sharing powers. So Congress must appropriate funds, but the president has to either sign the bill or his veto has to be overridden. So given that President Trump has said he's not going to sign a bill unless he gets $5.7 billion in funding for his so-called wall, and Congress seems unwilling to pass a bill and override a Trump veto, then we're stuck.
Talking to Roy Myers, political scientist at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, about the politics of shutdown, some of the history and evolution of the shutdown. It seems like what has happened since the early 80s now is that every now and then, maybe more and more often, one side or the other picks one issue, sets it as a red line and says, hey, we're going to, you've described this as a game of chicken. We're going to play a game of chicken if we don't get what we want here.
Right. And so the big change was in 95 and 96, as you mentioned in your intro. In 1994, Newt Gingrich led the Republicans to a significant electoral victory and took control of the House. And during that campaign, the Republicans pledged that they were going to honor something that they called the Contract with America. And one of the provisions, or several of the provisions in that document, said that the Republicans weren't going to cut government spending and produce a balanced budget. So they came into office with obligation to honor that pledge. And so they presented President Clinton with some appropriations bills that were very, very tough on spending. In addition, they wanted to cut so-called mandatory spending, such as Medicare, significantly. And President Clinton opposed both of those options. So in 1995, he vetoed a continuing resolution that would have cut spending pretty dramatically. And so there was a short shutdown in mid-November. And then they decided to end that shutdown and negotiate a little further, but neither side gave way. And then the long shutdown started on December 16th and actually went into 1996 and ended on January 5th.
Have we had enough shutdowns to learn about the political consequences? I mean, we can look at one particular one and say, okay, maybe the Republicans came out worse. But do we have a general sense of how political blame is apportioned in a shutdown?
Well, I think most experts believe that we know enough, but apparently the lesson hasn't been completely learned because we're in a big shutdown now. If you look at the 95-96 shutdown, the Republicans took significant blame, in part because they were being opposed by a very wily president, President Clinton, who was very good at communicating with the public, and he convinced the public, at least many members of the public, not all of them, that Republicans were out to cut what President Clinton called MMEE, which stood for Medicare, Medicaid, Education, and Environment, which are programs that many Americans really like. In 2013, Republicans again closed down the government because they wanted to force President Obama to repeal Obamacare. And now that's, of course, only the informal name for the Affordable Care Act, but it is kind of an amazing idea to think that you could try and use the threat of closing down the government to force a president to take away his signal legislative achievement. And of course, that didn't work either. And in that case, Republicans again received blame for the shutdown, although they really weren't hurt that seriously in the next election in 2014, in part because in the sixth year of a two-term presidential election, it's pretty difficult for a president to keep congressional seats. And, of course, there had been that mobilization of the Tea Party that started in 2010 that led towards the recruitment of some very strong Republican candidates and a lot of fundraising support for them.
Do you see a viable fix, whether it's congressional procedure, I don't know what, a viable fix to make these shutdowns less likely?
I don't think there's any procedural shift that can force members of Congress and the president to agree. Now, they could agree ahead of time to avoid these kind of situations by creating what we call an automatic continuing resolution, which would mean that if the regular appropriation bill isn't passed by the beginning of the fiscal year, which is October 1st, there would be an automatic temporary appropriation that could allow the agencies to stay open. The problem with that approach is getting agreement on what level that automatic continuing resolution would be. Republicans have proposed that the level be lower than current spending, and Democrats have proposed that it be higher, that is, adding for the effects of projected inflation. So, and again, we're back at the same kind of impasse between the Democrats and Republicans about what policy should be. The one thing that I think will change congressional and presidential behavior is political opposition to the kind of impasse that we see right now. And in part, that's going to occur if one side or the other or both is hurt at the ballot box. And I think actually in this particular case, it's quite likely that yet again, the Republicans are going to suffer much more blame than Democrats will. And that's in part because President Trump willingly accepted blame for causing a shutdown before it actually even occurred. And in part because he has yet to make a very convincing case for his demand of the wall, at least to most people.
We're talking to Roy Myers of the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, looking at the past and present of government shutdowns.
We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the fact that both parties seem to be adopting this as a way to negotiate? Do you remember the big shutdowns of the 1980s and 90s? What do you remember thinking at the time, and how has your reaction to government shutdowns changed since then? What are some ways to prevent these shutdowns? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or tweet us at Central Time WPR.
We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Darrell Conner. We continue our conversation about government shutdowns and how they've changed over the years. Roy Myers is with us from the University of Maryland, Baltimore County.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about government shutdowns, why they happen, how they work? Do you have thoughts on government shutdowns now or the ones of the 80s and 90s? And have you so far been impacted in some way? Are you a federal employee who is not getting paid today, have that pay stub that reads zero? Have you gone to a national park over the last couple of weeks? Are you looking for statistics or weather information that isn't out there now? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Steve starts us off in Sun Prairie. Hi, Steve.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have two comments / questions. You know, I'm 48 years old, and with all the shutdowns, the Republicans always get blamed. The media will always blame the Republicans. I've never heard of a situation where the media as a whole blame the Democrats. Secondly, you know, as an argument for the wall, I think Trump should do what Obama did in the gun control, that if it saves just one life, then we have an obligation to do it. And if that's enough for Obama for a gun control, that should be enough for Trump and the wall.
Steve, thanks for the call. First of all, Roy, do you think Republicans have been unfairly blamed for shutdowns, past or present, by the media?
No, not really, although I would agree with the caller to the extent that Democrats are not blameless in this. In fact, if you go back to early last year, Senator Schumer, in fact, led his Democrats to into a short-term shutdown because they were insisting that protection for Dreamers be added to an appropriations bill, and of course the administration didn't agree with that. But the difference is the Democrats came to their senses a little faster than Republicans seem to be doing now, and that they insisted that that shutdown continue, but only for a couple days.
And when it comes to the issue of President Obama on gun control and taking executive actions, President Obama did take actions, but they were limited to things that affected certain particular federal policies. They weren't spending bills that Congress would have had to sign off on.
Yeah, so if you're referring to the threat that President Trump has made recently that he might use the National Emergencies Act to, in effect, ignore Article 1 of the Constitution and the congressional power of the purse, that would be an extreme step, although I think President Trump this afternoon signaled that he would be unlikely to do that. I would like to comment about what the caller said regarding the wall, if it would save one life, that it's worth doing. You know, I think it's absolutely correct that border security is a very important policy issue. And the problem here is that right now we're not having a very good conversation either across the country as a whole or between the Congress and the president about how to cost-effectively do that. During the earlier discussion of the spending bill for the Department of Homeland Security, actually there was a better discussion. In fact, if you look at the House and Senate appropriation bills that have been drafted, in particular by Republicans, there's a significant investment in border security. And in fact, many Republicans in Congress have been unwilling to finance the wall because they think it's not cost-effective compared to, for example, investments in remote sensing technology. So really, in this particular case, it's President Trump insisting on one particular campaign pledge and not really doing the kind of presidential leadership which depends on persuasion to get his way with Congress.
Steve, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go now to Gary in Iron River. Gary, hi.
Yeah, good afternoon, guys. Say, I hear that 800,000 employees are furloughed and not being paid. And I also have read that the average cost for a government employee all in is $60 an hour. You calculate that out, it's $384 million a day we're wasting. And these people are going to get paid in the end. And the amount of time we shut off, they've been shut down, we could have paid for the wall. You couple that with the fact that Pelosi, Clinton, Trump, and Schumer have all said we need to spend money on a wall at one time or another in the last 10 years, and it's just sickening. They're like little children playing, all of them, and we're all being screwed by it.
Gary, thanks for the call. Roy, can you talk about the costs of a shutdown? Do we end up wasting money by virtue of the shutdown itself?
Yes. In fact, we waste a lot of money preparing for shutdowns, even if they don't occur. This is not the only time that a shutdown has been threatened and actually occurred, but there are many other times when a shutdown has been threatened and hasn't occurred. And what happens in the agencies is that they have to spend a lot of time preparing for shutdowns, and then when, in fact, if they do shut down, they have to start up their operations again. So I certainly agree with the caller. There's a lot of waste involved in this. Really, when you think about it, it doesn't make much sense to tell a federal worker who is providing a useful service to the country to stop doing so and then pay that worker anyway.
Talking to Roy Myers about shutdowns, past and present, the politics and history. We'll go next to Dominic in Oconomowoc. Dominic, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up?
Hi. So I guess it's kind of a rebuttal to the caller from Sun Prairie, I believe, from where he talked about the Republicans and kind of how they've kind of been unfairly portrayed in this. And I guess I'm kind of a little disappointed because we're seeing the House Democrats bringing about other budgets and versions to the floor and sending it over to the Senate, but now Mitch McConnell is not really bringing, having a vote on the floor. And I guess I'm very disappointed. And we have to look back and see that this is $5.7 billion. It's not some chunk change like some people are trying to make it out to be, and that we need to refocus and see what exactly, like how much or the bare minimum that we would need to bring compromise.
Gotcha. Dominic, Roy, do you see, and if you don't have a perfect solution right now, nobody will blame you, but do you see a path out of this current shutdown?
Well, I think eventually it'll come down to members of Congress and the president learning that they are violating an important norm in American politics, which is that it's good that we have full-blooded debates about our differences, but at the end we need to compromise and reach agreements to address the important problems in our country. And, you know, there are times when Congress and the president actually do that. And you know, take an issue that's important to Wisconsin, and for that matter to Maryland, where I live, which is agriculture. You know, they passed a farm bill recently, and it includes a lot of important things in it. But one of the problems with this shutdown is it's preventing what was adopted in the farm bill from actually being implemented by the Department of Agriculture. So if you're somebody who's, who's basically wants to go out and buy seed next for the next planting season, that's not possible now if you need an operating loan from the federal government to do that. So eventually there'll be enough, for example, farmers telling their senators, whether they're Democratic or Republican, that it's time to end this shutdown and allow the Department of Agriculture and the other agencies that aren't allowed to operate to do so now. What I hope is that members of Congress will take that criticism that they receive, and for that matter, President Trump, who I think deserves much more criticism, and will learn from it and not do this again.
We'll leave it there for now. Roy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Roy Myers, professor of political science and affiliate professor of public policy at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. He joined us today to talk about how government shutdowns have evolved in American politics and some thoughts on possible fixes for the risk of government shutdowns.
Coming up Monday on Central Time, a lot of people in their 50s and up want or need a job, but our guest says they're having a hard time finding one, even in the midst of an economic recovery.
Many policymakers and others ask and write and talk about how we can save rural America. Our guest says, hold on, we need to think of another way of framing this and start paying attention to the ways rural communities are actually saving themselves.
And we'll round up some of the most intriguing stories from the world of science.
That, and we'll take a look at some of the top news stories of the day, including likely an update on what's going on with the government shutdown we've just been talking about and the possible impacts on us here in Wisconsin. And of course, you can keep sharing your thoughts over at the Ideas Network Facebook page on that and other issues. And you can always tweet us at Central Time WPR. That's what to look for coming up Monday here on Central Time.